talking to Alan Rich in Los Angeles at home on, what are we up to today?
29, the date.
Today
is the 29th.
Anyway, you were starting to tell me why you were not surprised at...
What I was saying was that my life consists of wandering through a whole series of interlocking diasporae because there was the Herald Tribune crowd, some of which was the New York Magazine crowd, some not. Then out here there's the Pacifica crowd, KPFA and KPFK, and the defunct Herald Examiner, which I helped put to sleep a few years ago, and on it goes.
Right. Well, I want to start, actually, at the point where I've started with others, and it seems to be a very productive point to start. Mm-hmm. I can virtually ask the question and go out for a beer, which is, how did you first become associated with KPFA?
Well, it was at the very beginning. It was actually before the beginning. I was working as a clerk behind the counter of the Art Music Company on the corner of Telegraph and Channing.
And so was I, just after you.
Really?
Yeah.
That I didn't know. But one of my fellow clerks there was a guy named Bill Trieste. As a matter of fact, Bill and I both lived in San Francisco, and I used to ride over to Berkeley in Bill's car because I hadn't yet acquired my own. Bill began talking about this radio project that he had heard, that he had become involved in, and talking in a very glowing manner, and it seemed to me a little bit absurd, radio without commercials and radio devoted to, we're talking about 1947 and early 1948. And then the next thing I knew, Bill had left the Art Music Company and was actually involved in getting this station started.
And so he had, at this point, he was not working for one of the other radio stations by this time.
No, I don't know what he had done before he began at the record store.
He had been with KSMO and one or two other good music stations.
Maybe so. That I can't vouch for. It seemed to me that his life with me began when we were both behind the... You know, one of the other people behind that counter was Philip K. Dick.
Yes, I heard that recently.
Yeah.
And by one of those amazing things, Todd Machover, who's closely associated with Electric Phoenix, has said, there are only 100 people in the world.
I was extensively interviewed by at least two authors of Philip K. Dick biographies. I haven't seen either book. I presume they're out. And then your BBC did a documentary on Philip K. Dick, and they had me sitting at the piano and chatting about our time together at the record store. And we had become very good friends, as a matter of fact. We talked at one time about
the Elves, Gnomes, and Little Men's Chowder and Marching Society.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, Philip's first wife, Cleo, or at least, not I guess it wasn't his first wife, but the first wife since I knew him, was one of our favorite and most enthusiastic customers at the Art Music Company. She was in the process of discovering one masterpiece after another, and we were repeating her then. Anyway, to get back to KPFA, Bill left and came to start KPFA, which was at that time in a fifth or sixth floor, top floor of a building over on
University
Avenue. And we talked about my doing some things. I had, at that time, done some radio work while at Harvard at what is now WHRB, and we talked about doing a program. And then I'd worked in New York actually for a while as a announcer and programmer on a good music station. So we talked about doing a program of rare, out of the way recordings, and we did. I think I was on the air within the first couple of weeks after KPFA went on the air in April of 49, and became very much interested in what they were doing and became convinced that this was actually the start of something new and very interesting. And I loved the crowd there. I don't remember too many of the people, but I liked hanging out there, and I did quite a lot. And then I got a scholarship from the University of California and went off to Europe for a year. That was 52, 53. And...
But you were around long enough to have known Dick Moore, for instance.
Sure. I knew Dick. I knew Eleanor. I knew
Dick sends his regards to you, by the way. I spent a couple of days with him.
What is he doing?
He is retired up in Point Arena, up on the coast.
Near Eureka.
Just north of the mouth of the Russian River.
Oh, that's right.
Not so very far from where they had their little commune at Duncan's Mills
I love that area. I love Jenner, where the river comes into the ocean. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear he's alive and well. I'm sure we're going to catch up with all these
And he
mansions.
Is in a utterly beautiful house with his wife, Ruth, who is still alive and rather frail, I gather. Lovely lady.
Mm-hmm.
And the house is built for him by his builder's sons.
Oh, how wonderful.
And it is a work of art.
In the woods or on the ocean?
It's on the ocean, very close to the ocean. I mean, it's within easy sight of the ocean and about a minute's walk away across Highway 1.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anyway, so I started this radio series, then I went off to Europe, and not long after I'd come back from Europe, I got a phone.
Could I backtrack a minute?
Sure.
Because I wanted to ask you if you remember anything personal about Lou Hill.
At that time, no. Later on, yes.
Later on, yes. Okay,
but,
then I won't backtrack.
Yeah, I don't... I think I probably held Lou Hill in some kind of awe, and on the other hand, I don't think he was particularly interested in meeting classical music volunteers at that time, and except probably for Tony Boucher. But shortly after I was back from Europe, the phone rang, and it was Bill telling me that KPFA wanted to hire me as music director. And this was the first time I had known anything about the revolt, the Wallace Hamilton takeover, and all that. And I went down there immediately, I think that same night, and talked to the people there and found out what had happened.
Was this during the interregnum, or
yes?
Or
no, this was right at the start of the interregnum because Rick Chiarito had just left because he had left as part of the uprising, and I don't know whether he was fired or quit. I suspect he probably quit.
But Gert stayed on.
Gert stayed on. Yeah, she was there. So I went down and. I wasn't really taken by the visionary qualities of Wallace Hamilton or any of the other people that I talked to at the time, except for Bill and Chuck, and Chuck's girlfriend, wife, whatever, Virginia.
Virginia, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those were the people that sort of suggested to me that the idea was going on. And so I was hired at something like $50 a week and came down and planned the program folio and ran the live concerts. And I had a lot of connections of my own at that time, either through the music department at Berkeley or through customers at the record store. So I managed to keep a pretty good stream of live music concerts going at that time. Although I must say that I was a little bit intimidated by some of the more visionary aspects of their music programming. I was terrified of Harry Parch, for example. One of the last things that the station did before I came on was to run a Harry Parch live concert from International House, which I think meant actually stringing wires down Bancroft Way.
Was that the occasion on which Parch's works were recorded at International House, or was there a subsequent recording session at International House? Because there was one of the recordings that are around were made at International House.
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if some of them had begun as KPFA tapes. As I say, I wasn't involved with that. I it was just sort of on
this
the
was
edge.
pre-Gate 5.
Yeah. This was right after the Oedipus at Mills College, and I think Harry had actually moved over to Sausalito by that time, but the Gate 5 ensemble
Ensemble,
came in a little bit later.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I didn't really get along very well with the interregnum crowd. Wallace Hambleton struck me as kind of a self-serving egomaniac, and there was a little bit of argument there because I was also doing work as a TA at Berkeley at the time, and Wallace didn't think that I should be dividing my loyalties like that, even though neither job paid a living wage, and the two of them barely paid one coming together. And I agreed to go on three-quarters salary instead of full salary, if that placated them, since we were splitting hairs anyhow.
I mean, by any rational terms, you were already on half salary, so.
Exactly. Wallace put this said he would present it to the board, but that he was opposed to the idea. The board outvoted him, and Wallace never spoke to me after that.
There was madness in those days.
Anyway, within a few months into 1954, I had just had it. I hated the atmosphere there. I hated the fact that there was a whole faction of people who, under orders from Wallace, were not speaking to me. I went back to the Art Music Company. Then I went to summer of 54. I drove in my rattletrap A40 to New York and back. And by the time I got back,
Now, when did you go back to Art Music Company?
in the late spring of 1953, of 54, rather.
Late spring of 54. Right, okay. Then I was at Art Music Company in between you and you.
That's very possible.
Right, okay.
Excuse me. By the time I got back from my summer trip to New York, the revolution had reversed itself, and Lou and those people were back in, and they had hired Bob Erickson as
Hey, I just realized, I just remember now why, what happened. Because I was working at Art Music Company, and I got moved down to University Radio, and I got moved down to University Radio because somebody else was coming back in at Art Music Company, and they needed somebody to do the records down at University Radio, and they put me down there. So
Well,
that was how it happened.
this was all after Philip Dick, wasn't it? I mean, you didn't overlap him, did you?
Well, no, I didn't. I didn't know him. It's just that I discovered recently his association with all of that. But I knew some of the people involved with it. Anyway, excuse me, my interruptions, but I'm discovering my own life in the
I
process of
hope you
this
have
as
lots of
well.
tape.
I've got 4 hours there.
Oh, Lord. Can I talk?
Anyway.
So, anyhow, I came back from New York, went back to the Art Music Company, but Bob had started at KPFA and didn't, I guess, was not very comfortable about doing that full time. And he convinced Lou to hire me back half time as his assistant. So Bob and I worked together through 54, 55, maybe 2 years. That, by the way, is all in here. This is a chapter from Bob Erickson's memoirs, of which I just happen to have an extra copy.
Mon Dieu.
So this will, since he is in terrible physical shape, this will save you a lot
Oh, that's
of
wonderful,
grief.
wonderful.
Since Bob knew that my real ambitions were in criticism, Bob set me up with a 15-minute weekly commentary. And it began to make quite a name for itself. This was at the time when the San Francisco Symphony, after 2 years of guest conductors, had finally settled on a replacement for Pierre Monteux in the person of Enrique Jordá.
And you came up with your immortal subsequent third season of regret.
Oh, considerably.
I have quoted that bon mot for years.
Third season of regret?
Well, they had the season of discovery.
Oh, that's right.
And then the season of decision.
Decision and the season of regret.
You suggested the season of regret.
Yeah, well, I might very well have.
You sure as hell did. I remember it well.
Well, the program lit some fireworks, I must say. And
now, I have a memory, correct me if I'm wrong, of your being phoned up by the San Francisco Symphony and asked politely if you were unhappy with your seat or with some other arrangement implying that they were perhaps not treating you quite right and that this is why you were being nasty to them on the air.
This is the traditional stance between performing organizations and critics. They never could possibly occur to them that the reason that I was unhappy was that their music was so lousy. It had to be something else. It had to be Enrique Jordá or his wife had turned down a personal request or something along
that. Snubbed you.
It is ever so. I don't remember that.
I have a memory of being told that at the time. Anyway, never mind.
But something did happen along those lines that you'll read about a little bit in there, and that is that pressure was brought to bear on Lou Hill to drop my criticism by people who were potential donors. And this was a little bit unfortunate of Lou, but he really tried to pressure me into relaxing my grip on Enrique Jordá's throat. And
feet of clay.
Yeah, exactly. Well, apparently, the man at the involved at the other end was none other than James D. Zellerbach, the toilet paper king of the Bay Area, and
whose family Duesenberg I owned in college.
Wow. Well, maybe I shouldn't be telling you this. Then what are you?
Well, I didn't get it from them.
What are your connections? Anyway, it was Bob who finally convinced Lou that this would be a very unfortunate step for the station to take. And as I say, that's somewhat in there.
Good old Bob. Everybody has, in every music director, ex-music director I've talked to, has said that that Bob Erickson remained a very powerful eminence grise behind the music department over a long period of years after he ceased to serve on the staff.
Well, to Bob I owe a great deal of my whole take on the musical world. I mean, we had long conversations. We spent a lot of time in the studio playing Haydn quartets, four hands. It was practically a whole extracurricular musical education working with Bob. And, of course, through Bob, I got to develop a much closer identity with the contemporary scene because composers came, composers went. I became friendly with a man in San Francisco who was putting up a lot of money for contemporary music concerts by the name of Hans Popper. He invited me over one night to a dinner party that he was throwing for a recently arrived friend of his by the name of Boulez. And Boulez was there and played music that I had never heard of, including his own Marteau sans Maître and Stockhausen's Song of the Holy Children. And I said, we got to have this on KPFA. So I talked Boulez into coming over, I guess, the next morning or the morning after, and submitting to a panel discussion. And I got on the phone and feverishly rounded up Bob Andrew Imbrie, Arnold Elston.
Yeah.
Webern pupil on faculty at that time. And Jack Holloway, a lesser composer of the time.
Him.
Anyhow, we had a lively 45 minutes in the studio with Imbrie attacking Boulez on almost any front.
Mm-hmm. What's the date on this again, approximately?
54. I can tell you 54. Exactly. I have a copy of the tape.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, we'll get back to that.
I could be running a dub for you if you want.
I would adore a dub.
Well, why don't you turn off your machine then?
Okay. Right. We're moving again from the point when you were talking about this interview.
Yeah. well. Where do I go from here? I mean, this interview, this Boulez thing, was typical of KPFA's position of leading the taste of San Francisco toward an awareness of what was going on in the contemporary world. As early, way back at the very beginning, the KPFA had broadcast the West Coast premiere of the Bartok Sonata for Two Pianos and Percussion that was done in its studio up on University Avenue, with one person, Peggy Cunningham, playing the timpani, the percussion part that was composed for two players. And it was typical of KPFA that this is what happened. They performed, Bernhard Abramovich and Leonard Rosenman, I think it was, played the sonata, and immediately the phones started ringing like crazy. Everybody just amazed at this music. So they played it again. They just, you know, canceled programming and did a second performance then and there. And that was...
I recorded that same work in Hertz Hall in about 1960, it would have been, the time of an internet, I think a music library convention that was held in Berkeley, and Peggy Cunningham was one of the percussionists for that performance.
It sort of made her reputation around contemporary music circles that she could do that.
Could I ask, just jumping ahead, just a frame to my, in my own mind, what was the date at which you ceased to be the music director at KPFA?
Oh, that was in the fall of 1960. When Harold Winkler sent me as St. Paul to the Romans to help out at WBAI in New York.
Well, I didn't want to jump to that point except just to remind myself of the frame that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, going back. Now you had a you had an assistant in the music department, didn't you?
Yeah. It got to the point where, first of all, the station had expanded the broadcasting hours, which meant that time that we were expanding the hours of recorded concerts, and I convinced them that I needed somebody to file records and type up scripts and that sort of thing. And Bob suggested a young composition student of his by the name of Lauren Rush.
With whom I spent all of the afternoon 2 days ago in Woodside.
Well, Lauren and I both take a certain amount of pride that I gave him, that he earned some of his first money in music by filing records in the music office at 2207 Shattuck. He's done well for himself.
Well, he said that he also had a lot to do with doing the outside live concerts. Worked into that along the way.
He did a lot of. I gave him free rein because I understood where he was at. I gave him free rein to arrange a lot of concerts, both in the studio and I guess maybe some outside too, with people like Pauline Oliveros, who was a good friend of his, and Mort Subotnick, and the whole crowd that eventually became the San Francisco Tape Music Center. were very much involved with KPFA, and Lauren, with his enthusiasms as well as his skills, handled a lot of that stuff, did a lot of and also, I think, produced some of the studio concerts in the studio, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah. Now,
who was a 7 or 8 year old brat who was pushed by Virginia into exposure far beyond his abilities as a reader of children's stories. I
mean, now, I'm not interested in gossip for the book, but what was the nature of the relationship between Chuck and Virginia? I mean, in legal terms. I'll turn this off. I say this. I'm not remotely interested in writing gossip for this thing because I don't think it's necessary. And we're not dealing with world celebrities of the kind where editors are going to demand, how many times they checked off on the 14th of April in 1957.
No, we're dealing with the birth of an idea and its formative years and I presume something of its spread into contemporary life.
Right. Okay, so we're taking off from somewhere in the vicinity of 1957.
Mm-hmm. Well, my life at KPFA was... I was as dedicated to making that station run as I've ever been to anything. I think that between 1954, or say 55, whenever it was that I became full-time music director, and the time I left to go to New York in 1960, except for one vacation trip, there was not a day in the week, including Saturdays and Sundays, that I didn't spend some time in that building. I inherited the job of folio editor. I was capable of running the board, including Combo. I produced a lot of the studio concerts myself and did the programming. I moved my own record collection down to the KPFA offices in order to be able to program a little bit more conveniently than to have to schlep stuff from home. And, of course, what I didn't have, we were able to borrow from people like Thos Tenney.
Yes, my God, those days. It would be interesting if you could run through, not necessarily in chronological order or with dates attached, some of the musical events that you remember having been responsible for or helped to happen while you were there. People, concerts, composers, performers.
Well, as far as composers are concerned, Bob kept his hand in with the station long after he actually resigned as co-music director, and a great deal of what happened along those lines were things that he brought in. I kept house and worked around my own innate interest as far as programming was concerned. I remember producing a Schubert cycle in the studios with Bernhard, and I brought a old Egon Petri back to the studios after several years of obscurity, and he gave some wonderful concerts there. Things like the complete Busoni Fantasia Contrapuntistica. I did some pretty good interviews, I must say, with Elizabeth Schwarzkopf when she came to town to start her American opera career. I did a pretty good program, which I still have on tape, with Paul Badura Skoda right after the publication of his book on Mozart interpretation, where he actually sat at the piano and gave an hour's illustrated interview on Mozart. Things like that, which subsequent music directors at KPFA might have regarded as a little bit old-fashioned were some of the things that I took particular pride in.
Mm-hmm. Well, for whatever it's worth, I this sounds like too much like ass kissing, but I'll say it anyway. None of the subsequent music directors that I have spoken to, they've all spoken of you at length, and none of them have spoken of you with anything but reverence.
Can I have that on tape?
So far as what you did was concerned, there's no suggestion that you ever did anything less than extremely well.
Well, that's partly because I chose my targets carefully, and it's also partly because, as I say, there was 4 or 5 years there where I lived and breathed mm-hmm. at the station. Mm-hmm. It was my social life as well, and I loved it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I keep coming back to what I wrote at the end of my own first installment, that I felt that that people at Pacifica were able to achieve what they did not so much because they were uniquely talented, but because they could afford the luxury of habitual integrity.
Mm.
And there are not many places that one can write for where you don't have to think about what you're writing or saying in terms of, is this going to cost me my job?
Yeah. That's true. It never occurred to me that I would lose my job for any reason except my own volition. When Jack and I worked together at the Herald Tribune and then at New York Magazine, we spent a lot of time drawing parallels between situations that were coming up there, especially mm-hmm. getting this new magazine going through its first summer of 3 ad pages per issue. We spent a lot of time comparing that with comparable situations. We had our Elsa, we had our Gert.
Did you feel that you had the same kind of freedom to do what you wanted?
Oh, sure. I mean, after all, I had my hand on the explosive device because I ran the folio. I could.
No, I meant it on the New York magazine.
Oh no. No, as a matter of fact, something happened within, I think, the third or fourth issue that dramatized the difference between New York and KPFA. We ran a profile with some rather scandalous photographs by Deanne Arbus of one of Andy Warhol's stars named Viva.
Ah, yes.
And suddenly we had no advertising.
Oh, boy. Well, you were in the process of going through some of the things that sort of came back to your mind of what you'd done at the station.
Well, those are the things. Well, my own stuff. I go listen to those tapes now and then, and they're not all that bad. A series on the history of music that ran something like 21 weeks with musical examples in it, and a listening hour afterwards. I mean, I just redid that particular program series as a series of interactive compact CD-ROMs that's being produced.
I was
by
about to ask you that very question.
Yeah, well, there it is. I didn't actually go back and look at my scripts while I was writing the CD-ROM scripts, but everything that was in those scripts was ingrained in my awareness of music, and I think I carry the chronology a little bit further in the CD-ROM series, but life had gone on.
Yeah. Something I was going to ask you, and
I did that. I did a series on of Lieder recitals and on Reinhardt.
Oh yes, was it under your aegis that Abramovich did his Schubert cycle?
Yes.
Yeah. Incidentally, you pointed out the misspelling, with the missing Z at the end of the book. That was because my source in the folio didn't have the Z on it, and I thought, oh, I must have misremembered how he spelled it, and so I took the folio as my authority. There's a moral there for us all.
Was it one of my folios?
Well, it was a reprint of it in Blue Hill's book.
I remember, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that was mine.
Well.
Yeah, but the reprint wasn't a photo reprint of the folio in mm-hmm. those days. It was reset. So I'm sure it was just a typo in doing the book. Yes, there were some great local musicians that just came and did work for the minimum
for eight bucks a head.
Yeah.
Well, we had the Griller Quartet in the studio many times. We had most of the good local singers and a few that were not so good but were willing to work up interesting programs. We had some of the early authentic music buffs. There was a man who lived up in the hills named Martin Dangot, and people spoke of him with awe because he was one of the first civilians to ever own a harpsichord. And people used to meet at his home, and we brought some of those people mm-hmm. to the studio.
An old friend has asked me to ask you what you know of Martin Chuzit.
Martin Chuzit is the country's leading authority on Verdi. I think he still teaches at NYU, uh-huh. but he is the president of the International Verdi Society, which is preparing a monster edition of all the operas with all the corrections and all that. Another person who's working on that series and who's actually conducted a number of performances with cleaned-up scores is David Lawton, who is the son of Ed Lawton, the conductor of the Cal Chorus.
Oh, my goodness.
No? The world mm-hmm. continues to shrink.
Yeah, and that was something I was going to come to. Whatever you think of off the top of your head by free association of people who, not necessarily just in music that you know of, that have sort of passed through KPFA and on into other things of interest.
Well, John Leonard comes immediately to mind.
Well, the ones that come immediately to mind to me, of course, are Pauline Kael,
Alan Watts,
John Leonard, and Jack Nessel, mm-hmm. Virginia McKenna. It's a hole in my head. The one who went on to head up the Broadcasting Foundation of America. Eleanor McKinney. Yeah.
Is she still of this world?
Yes, she is. Mm-hmm. I interviewed her at length over the telephone for that first installment that I did.
Uh-huh.
And I've talked to her within the last couple of months.
Where is she?
She's in the Midwest someplace. She remarried an African musician, somebody told me, and her name is now Shawanda, Swende, I think.
Could she have married Phila Swende? There was an African composer by that name. It's probably like Smith, but
That's entirely. Is he of the right generation?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the answer is probably yes.
I reviewed his New York debut when I was with the Herald Tribune.
Oh my God! And what? He's a composer. You say?
Yeah,
I'm not familiar with him.
Composer who came to Carnegie Hall with a native group and played some of his music. I More than that, I don't remember, but I have huge scrapbooks in the back that I could look it up in.
Well, that's just a matter of curiosity rather than, you know, essential information. But yes, you bet your egg on Petri. I was briefly engaged to his, great niece or something of this sort. Chris Petri. She came over to London long after you left.
Mm-hmm.
That she was staying with Ulla for a while.
No, I didn't know her. Well, how far ahead in history should we go? I mean,
well, I'm taking this.
We haven't reached Harold Winkler yet.
No, we haven't. We should. I'm taking this to the present time, so I'm outside of the musical associations. I don't know the extent of your involvement, so I'm going to ask if I can be led by you rather than the other way around. As to what we talk about.
Yeah. Well, Lou killed himself, and the station was in an uproar for a while, and one looked to Bill Webb, who was the original man who tried to found KPFK here, as some kind of leader, and that didn't really work. Bill, what do you know about the KPFK history? I'm not the one to give you very much.
Very little, but I'm not working on any of the Pacifica stations at this point other than KPFA, because there's just so much to do there.
Well, there is some inevitable overlap.
Right, okay, insofar as there is, then I would then I should know.
Well, my own feeling, and sort of an inside-outsider, was that a lot of the pressure on Lou that brought about his decision to kill himself had to do with a great deal of objection on the board to the expansion to KPFK, that it was we were spending a lot of money, and there was also, I think, maybe you'd better check this with somebody else, but Bill Webb, who was the man down here starting the station, along with a man named Denny Wiltshire, was in the peyote crowd. He was a friend of Aldous Huxley, and also a very interesting man that I've always wanted to track down, that I met in the times I was staying at Bill's house, by the name of Henry Geiger, who put out he was sort of the I.F. Stone of the West Coast, except in the LSD area. He put out a one-man newsletter called Manas, M-A-N-A-S. And it was a very inspirational publication to my naive outlook. Anyway, and of course Elsa was down here working with Bill, getting the station going. Anyhow, that didn't work out, and Harold Winkler came on, and then the...
Harold Winkler, I do remember from research, was one of the original committee that was sort of selected out of the community to help sort out KPFA and its hours of trial going back to back to the time when Lou Hill was out and the interregnum was in.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about that. I knew that Harold was one of those people who had been given a raw deal at the university because he was so popular as a teacher that his fellow political scientists denied him tenure.
Can such things be?
Such things. I've been racking my brain for years to try to think of the most famous case of that. It was an English professor who...
Sears Jane?
You've done it.
Yeah. I was inside of that. I mean, I was very, very close to it.
Uh-huh.
I was his TA for a term.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Sayers.
Jane, J-A-Y-N-E.
Yeah, I remember that.
Mm-hmm. My God. As the great Yogi Berra once said, it's deja vu all over again.
Right, right. I've really worked on that man's name. You know, you get at a certain age, you wake up in the morning struggling to remember your own name.
No, don't tell me. I have a dear friend in Chicago that's about my age, a little bit older, and we have these long literary discussions in which the crucial name comes up. It's about to prove the point. And, well, you remember that work by Dr. Alzheimer. when we can't think of the name,
mm-hmm, right.
We don't stop. We wait for it to come later on. But anyway, you were talking about Winkler.
Oh, Winkler came on, and brought his own personality, his own way of doing things in, and was pretty highly regarded at the beginning. But then, as the idea of expansion was reborn, with the founding of KPFK down here, which was engineered largely by a bright young guy named Terry Drinkwater, and followed soon after that by the gift of WBAI, all kinds of controversy began to stir up. And the Felix Green thing, you better really find out from other people, because I wasn't close enough to that.
Oh, I've dealt with that somewhat in the article.
Did. Yeah,
and I've had some pretty good sources on that.
Uh-huh. There was also a couple of other Cal professors who were making some trouble. Who wrote Failsafe? Burdick,
Gene,
yeah.
Burdick.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. That right-wing Catholic paper in New York began to attack Winkler at about the time of the WBAI acquisition, using people like William Mandel as... Mm-hmm.
Was that Barron's? Or was that another publication that attacked her?
No, it was called Frontline... that's not right. It was a Catholic publication, nowhere near Dorothy Day, of course, published in Brooklyn, which sort of called the shots on Aptaker, Mandel.
Dorothy Healy, probably.
Yeah, right. Anyhow... it produced an atmosphere of at KPFA of intense factionalism that, I guess, went back to as the worst days of Blue Hill. During the summer that Hal went to New York, I guess the summer of '60, that Hal spent most of his time in New York, public relating the birth of. Where were we? Oh, yeah. That summer I was serving as active station manager. And I guess whatever the anti-Winkler forces consisted of, I think they're mostly led by Elsa, kind of gravitated to me. And there was, by the time Hal came back, there was a groundswell in which I did not participate but was thoroughly aware of to make me permanent station manager. At that point, Hal was feeling very beset by all these political problems, and he decided the easiest thing to do would be to offer me a job in New York.
He did, under pressure, let Aptheker go, didn't he?
He didn't. He let Aptheker go in New York. I think also Mandel. I don't think Mandel was on in New York.
Oh, I see. Off the New York station.
Yeah.
Because he was certainly on in
He was on in Berkeley, but he didn't. He did not pick up on.
Yeah, well, that.
Because I remember meeting Aptheker, and before he said hello, he gave me an earful about the raw deal he had been offered in New York.
Yes. Well, I. It's been the consensus of people who knew him better than I that Tal Winkler was not a person to whom you handed a stiletto and then turned your back.
Exactly. Well, I learned that over the time over my time at WBAI, because what he basically did was to send me to a non-existent job that was already being held by somebody else. Mm-hmm. And so that when I got to New York, it was a matter of a very difficult sorting out of territories between me and the continuing music director at WBAI. And it ended up not very pleasantly.
Yeah.
And so I got the urge one day to wander over to the New York Times. I was doing some freelance writing. Wander over to the New York Times and see what the chances were of coming on as a music critic. Harold Schoenberg knew my work. He said, I'd hire you in a minute if I had an opening. And a week later, he had an opening.
And a minute later, you were hired.
Yeah, right.
And the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. Yes, as they say.
One of the big things about KPFA, of course, in its the way that it influenced one's thinking about and feeling about political matters, was that KPFA and the battery-operated tape recorder grew up more or less together.
Well, the battery-operated tape recorder had its baptism of fire on the day that the HUAC, that the students reacted against HUAC in San Francisco City Hall.
Yeah, 1960, and those were the days of the Butoba, which sort of required a posse of pallbearers to convey it to the location.
Well, we Betty Ford Aquino, do you know her? A painter, a writer, with a horribly ugly voice, but a lot of money, so that we put her on the air, had brought back the 19th wonder of the world, an Uher.
Oh, good Lord! Yes, because the Butoba actually preceded the Uher.
But the Uher was not that big.
No, it wasn't. No, the Uher was a much better machine.
Oh, sure.
And it lived out its life, for many, many years.
Yeah, well, I had the use of one for some recordings I was doing in Salzburg as late as 1981, and it was a glory to use.
It was great for those who couldn't afford an Agra, which was an awful lot of people.
That was the other word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but nowadays, there sits that thing which in emergency I have recorded symphony orchestras on for CD and for broadcast. And nobody cares. And in the long play mode, its characteristic is not quite as good. It only goes down to the frequency response of full range FM broadcasting, about 15K.
Well, at our age, it shouldn't matter.
I can still hear bats.
At our age, the rest is silence.
Oh.
Okay, did we come to the end of the program or merely the end of the tape? I can't remember whether.
I hadn't been watching the dials with meters. So.
Gentlemen, perhaps this is a good place to stop. Thank
well, that sounds like an end.
That's Erickson.
Pierre Boulez for being with us today.
Good God.
Good God.
Well, I just what was a year or two ago, I talked to Sidney Griller before he died just a few months ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And it's sad because I think it was a year or two ago, time flies so much, that I was looking at the vital statistics page in the Guardian and noted that it was his 80th birthday.
Huh.
And so I phoned him up to wish him happy birthday. And he remembered me immediately, and we had a nice little chat on the phone. He said, "Do come around for tea." And I said, "Yes, I would love to." And I never got around to do it. And then it was too late.